This week's episode of Still Entitled is made possible with support from the Rochester Institute of Technology. Faculty and students there recently built a robot fish. Why? Because it could lead to a new wave of prosthetics, and now we're all hooked. At RIT, that creative team of engineers is on to something life-changing. Learn more about the project at rit.edu/untitled. Now on with the show.
Welcome to Still Untitled, the Adam Savage Project. I'm Will.
I'm Adam.
And I'm Norm.
Light clipping today.
Did that clip at the beginning?
Just a little bit, yeah.
Well, it wouldn't be a proper podcast if it didn't clip to properly.
Our audio engineer is off today.
It's been a hot minute since we all got together. Last week, we didn't podcast last week because we had Adam's Maker Faire Sunday Sermon as the episode last week. So I hope you all out there enjoyed that. So we have quite a bit. I don't think we've podcasted together since we talked about Avengers Endgame.
That was okay.
I went and saw it again.
I haven't yet.
Still, I cried even more. I found it even more affecting.
I feel really bad because John Wick came out this week and I haven't seen it yet either.
I haven't either.
I didn't.
Plenty of time to watch that.
So I wanted to go back and go see both of those movies and just have not had time. Detective Pikachu out. I kind of want to see that.
Out.
Because it looks like a real amazing, it looks like the Roger Rabbit of our time.
A little bit of noir.
Yeah.
Murder mystery.
Yeah, but
But Endgame. Okay, you went to see it. Did you see it in like IMAX or a regular theater?
I just saw it in a regular theater twice.
Was it packed still?
Yeah, both times. We saw it at the Alamo Draft House the second time. And yeah, we were off to the side.
Wow.
I'm glad to hear that people who are watching the box office are nervous now because the drop-off, it's closed its run in some places overseas. I think it's wrapped up its run in China. And so it might not beat Avatar as the highest grossing film ever, even though everyone thought it was a foregone conclusion.
Wow.
It would do that after the first weekend's success.
Jim Cameron can rest in peace.
Did you notice things in this new viewing that you didn't the first time? Or do you connect with pieces more?
I connected with it more. So my wife has not been as assiduous about logging all the Marvel films that I have.
I'm shocked.
Yeah.
Sir.
Shocked. But I will tell you that after we went and saw Captain Marvel, we were both so like high on Marvel love that we came home and immediately watched Guardians 1.
Yeah.
And then the next night we watched Guardians 2. And the next night we watched... we didn't watch Civil War. No, a few nights later we watched Winter Soldier.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we went and saw Endgame, we came back and the next night we watched Ragnarok. And we finished that last night. So it's like, it's just back in that lovely, it was just like going back into that lovely universe. And I found it even more affecting the second time. I found the emotional beats hit me nice and hard. And wow, I love it when Captain Marvel goes, "Hello, Peter Parker."
Yeah.
I am so excited for like 10 years from now when somebody writes the How This All Happened book. Because if you look at the run from like Civil War or Black Panther, or probably Civil War through Ragnarok and Black Panther, all the stuff that came out in the back half of Phase 3 leading up to Endgame and Infinity War. And like they didn't really mess up. Like, they had a million different teams working on these movies.
Yeah.
They were releasing two or three a year, which is, that's ludicrous.
It's ludicrous. And then you watch Ragnarok, which we finished last night, and it's like, I love that my primary question after watching it is, how did a studio get out of this movie's way?
Right.
Like, just to let it happen with Taika Waititi's, all of his in-jokes from New Zealand that the rest of the world won't get, and still it has this magical...
Well, yeah. Sakaar is Space New Zealand. We've established that now.
I think after movie 10, they realized they couldn't, once they were done with the origin stories, they realized they, in order to keep things fresh, they had to give creative control. And, you know, credit to the producers there, to hire directors who are different and have unique visions. And, you know, they knew that a movie this big was going to have the beats to sell, right? They're going to have the big action beats.
Yeah, and yet... I think that Lucasfilm, having done such extensive reshoots on Rogue One that we now know were deeply extensive, yeah. and what Solo. Seems like an entirely separate film being shot with Solo.
Yeah, we can get Solo 2 next year.
It's an easy thing to screw up.
Well,
I'm not saying that I know why Lucasfilm screwed up. I don't know if they got in the way or got way too out of the way. Like, and that might not be a knowable thing.
I think that with the Star Wars universe, and it's all under the same umbrella, under Disney, right? Although, of course, Marvel has its own executive team, mm-hmm. and of course, Lucas has its own executive team. In terms of what the fans expect with Marvel, there's a comic universe that the first, like, six movies were really reverent to.
Right.
And it got to a point where the cinematic universe could be its own thing and people would trust that.
Right.
With Star Wars, there's nothing but the movies that people hold as the most precious thing. And maybe that's why
that could
they
be.
Put more weight into it.
I feel like if you look at Thor as the example, right? It opens, I mean, we were talking about this before the show. It opens a little bit slow. It isn't just an absolute barn burner. It isn't like the opening of Guardians 2 they had this incredible fight and it's like all it picks up right where it left off before.
Yeah. And rewatching Guardians 1 and 2 and Ragnarok, which I had kind of put all under the same heading in my head, they're radically different films. And Guardians 1 and 2 are just an unfettered, super fun romp all the way through.
I mean, Ragnarok opens with the how did I get here?
No,
with
the I know it does. Right. I'm just saying, having watched the two within the same week, Ragnarok feels like a little bit slower to bring you into this like weird, wonderful universe.
Well, but at the same time, Ragnarok opens with Led Zeppelin, which is the thing you've kind of been waiting for from Thor the entire time. And then they play the song again at the end of the movie, and it's so satisfying. And it's like, oh.
I was thinking about this because I was watching the finale last night, and I was thinking of, I read this wonderful analysis of Zack Snyder and the DCEU, the DC.
Universe.
In that, they said one of the difficulties is that Snyder sets up these surpassingly beautiful visual moments, but does not frequently support them with the emotional beats that bring the catharsis.
Yeah.
So it's Superman standing there getting healed by the sun, but you haven't been drawn in, so it's not affecting you the same way. Whereas Ragnarok, when Thor is following the bolt of lightning into the, you know, all the enemies, you are, it's like Taika showing this is how you do it.
I also love that someone like Taika Waititi didn't need to immediately jump into the next Thor. Like, he's directing Akira as his next movie. Yeah. And what a wonderful decision to do that and not be locked into, even though, of course, having huge ownership into the Thor that we now know in this version of Thor, he can still let that go.
Here's the thing, though. This version of Akira is now entering its 20th year of development, I think.
Well, so, and everyone's been attached at some point. Yeah, Cameron, Columbus, Chris Cunningham.
It's everybody, but
not Chris Columbus, Chris Cunningham.
Yeah, not Chris Columbus. but yeah, I'll be interested to see if that gets made.
Same thing with Snow Crash, right? It's one of these like,
I would love a Taika Waititi Snow Crash.
Oh my Holy god! Shit. By the way, I'm halfway through Fall.
Oh, you have it?
Yeah.
Oh, I hate you so much. Oh, my God. I even went fishing on Twitter. I was like, man, I'm really jealous of all these people with the Fall Galley.
What can you say? Are you under embargo?
I almost sent you a picture of me with the copy and just holding up the middle finger.
Wait. So explain. Explain.
Fall is Neal Stephenson's new book, which involves Dodge Forthrast, a character from Reamdi.
Yeah.
Which is...
I might go back and read Reamdi in the interim.
And it is worth rereading. Okay. I want to reread it after
this. It's probably my least favorite of the Neal Stephenson oeuvre.
Well, it's way outside his normal dive. And yet I love Reamdi in the same way that, like, Vineland is a great Pynchon novel.
Yeah.
It's fun and funny and sweet.
Or Summerland and Chabon.
Right. It falls outside their normal canon, but it's still really... Look, I loved it.
Can you say anything about the plot? Does it have a hook like Seven Leaves does?
I have to say, actually, Neal gave me a tiny synopsis, and I wished I hadn't had it. I wanted to go in super cold.
Like,
who is it for fans of? Fans of Neal? Fans of Seven Leaves? Fans of...
So I will say this, and this isn't a spoiler. It actually covers it. So I'm halfway through and we're already like 25 years in the future
of RIMD. RIMD was present day, right?
RIMD is absolutely present day. So this is 25 years from there, from now. And he is positing a very interesting and what a deeply feels like a deeply realistic future where facts are something you choose based on your tribe.
Oh, I don't want
to read this. I'm curious, for him, is it easier to write a story set 10 to 20 years in the future or a story set 1,000 years in the future?
Yeah, I feel like it's easier to do the... look, I'm not a science fiction author, so I have no answer. I mean, Bill Gibson seems to me that 1,000 years is easier.
Bill Gibson said writing a science fiction story set in the present is the hardest thing he did.
Yeah.
Right? Like with pattern recognition in that trilogy, the Blue Ant trilogy or whatever. I don't know what people call it.
All Tomorrow's... No.
Spook Country. Pattern recognition, Spook Country, and I can't remember the last one, but I liked it a lot.
Hey, all the Marvel films we set 5 years in the future.
What's that?
All the Marvel films are now set five years in the future.
So they are. So they are. Unless it takes 3 years for one to come out.
No, they're going to be having
that. I think they probably got it covered.
Well, where do you think the Marvel films can go from here?
I mean, Spider-Man, they're going to go to Europe, I think.
Yes, that is the next film coming out in a month or a half. Well done, dad joke.
I'm actually really excited about As Guardians of the Galaxy.
If that is the film...
Gunn, James Gunn, who's back in directing Guardians 3, has said that Guardians 3 will deal a lot more with Rocket's backstory. Mm. And I'm super excited.
Yeah.
Because frankly, and look, we're now going to talk some spoilers. Like when Rocket and Nebula hold hands in Endgame, it affected me. That might be one of the most affecting bits. And Gunn was saying that Rocket is him. The misfit that Rocket is the character Gunn most identifies with.
He's a misanthrope who becomes an anthrope. I don't know what the opposite of misanthrope is.
But in terms of escalation, right? If we spent 10 years and 22 films building up to this
with Thanos, the biggest, is it Galacticus? I don't know.
Or can it doesn't even make sense to have a type of buildup? Like
I don't know.
Isn't it more important like this? Or the stakes, because we've talked about this in the past, one of the reasons, like, there's a whole trend of movies that we didn't really like because the world being at stake every time got boring.
It's kind of the problem with Mission Impossible, right?
And Thanos works because, yes, one, it is the universe at stake, and they hammer that in, but it's also very personal. It is their friendship, the friends that they lost.
It's Gamora's dad, right? Like,
there's all sorts of interesting stakes as the films progress, doesn't it?
I think that my hope is that they'll spend a few years introducing new characters.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, they have mutants and Fantastic Four and some other folks to integrate and bring into the world. And that gives them an opportunity to tell smaller stakes stories for a while while they build to the next 10 years.
I think it's going to be Peter Parker. I think what they have the luxury of knowing that they can map out a 10-year plan is the audience grows up with the characters.
I'm really curious if they're going to do a Falcon Captain America film.
It's going to be a TV show.
Oh, right. That's with him and Sebastian Stan. Yes. That's right.
Yeah.
Hey, I saw Alita Battle Angel.
That movie's amazing.
Dude.
I watched it twice in theaters.
This is the thing. I didn't know what we were going to get. I didn't, you know, you never know what Christoph Waltz kind of, with a trailer
is,
like that.
Yeah.
And then, so one of my oldest friends, a screenwriter, was like, he's like, it's totally decent. There's no villain, but she's great. And I agree, there is a villain.
The villain is the world, kind of.
Yeah. I thought it was fantastic. I really enjoyed the spit out of it. Yeah. And in the canon of PG-13 movies, choosing one F-bomb, hers after she jams and breaks off she jams her fist into the eye of the villain that snaps off her arm. As she says, fuck your mercy.
That is such... And that is a transition from... Because it's James Cameron who wrote the script consolidating several of these books.
Right.
And in the manga, that villain who's there, he has those tentacles.
Yeah.
He takes a different direction because I believe in the manga, like, he's secretly in love with her, infatuated with her.
Right.
But there is that very much scene where she gets reduced to nothing but essentially an arm.
Yeah.
And for someone, you know, having a robot body, like, that is nothing. How could she get out of this? And the way he and Robert Rodriguez brought that scene and scripted the action around it, it is worth seeing.
It was effective.
I was really impressed.
I thought it was really lovely. Did you watch it in a hotel or something? Or were
yeah,
you?
I watched it in a hotel on a big screen.
Yeah.
Rosa Salazar is, plays Alita.
Yeah, I was blown away.
It's a terrific
by that
performance. There's a few Uncanny Valley moments. Her face is a little too smooth in a couple of spots, but I didn't really mind that. There's
a full
character there.
Well, they said that if you watch the very first trailer for that.
Oh, yeah, the eyes are much bigger.
The eyes are smaller. It turns out making the eyes bigger helps with the pupils. Sorry.
Oh,
making the pupils, bigger helps with the
They shrunk the eye size a little bit and they made the pupils bigger.
Because then you don't have to believe it's a human.
Yeah. Interesting.
I mean, this is why if you're doing something with weird CG animation like I do for a living, then it's better to do cartoons than real people because you don't get skeezed out.
I forgot to mention this. Julia was asking me yesterday, how many Valkyries are cosplaying these days?
That's a great question.
My experience was I couldn't call to mind more than a couple that I'd seen recently.
Yeah. Yeah. And maybe at Comic-Con, we'll see a lot more.
I definitely, we'll she asked about year. Hela. Mm-hmm. I mean, because
I've seen a bunch of
I've seen a Hela hats.
Hela I've seen a ton. And really wonderful versions of it. And Down in Creative made one.
Yes. And I think Hela is striking because the makeup is so much part of it. And there's a challenge in building the headdress, the antlers. And Valkyrie is only in her final outfit. Her battle outfit.
Right, Valkyrie could work. I mean, so if you do cosplay as Valkyrie, tweet to us or me or put it in the comments because I'd love to see your Valkyrie costume. I think there should be more.
Tessa Thompson is
so amazing in that film.
I love the Tessa Thompson scrapper Valkyrie when we first see her, when she's obviously hammered, can't work her ship. Like, you know, it's so good.
You know,
it's such
one
a good
of the
moment.
Problems that movies that try and play with that comedy. Real stakes and comedy stakes have is it's easy to lose track of what stakes I'm supposed to care about. And amazingly, Ragnarok never loses which stakes are important and which stakes are jokey. And yet, you know, Jeff Goldblum, while being ludicrous and ridiculous, is still a scary villain. He's still dangerous.
So there's a great, if you want to know more about Thor Ragnarok, there's a great podcast that a friend of the site, Chuck Wendig, and Anthony Carboni do called Thor Ragnatalk. And they break down, I think, a minute of or 2 minutes of each, or maybe it's a five-minute chunk of each. Each episode is only talking about 5 minutes. They get a guest each week.
Wow.
So they bring in, like, they broke in the movie in these little tiny bits.
And they've made a podcast series
And they've
out
made
of
a
it.
Podcast series out of it. It's a very good
podcast.
What
is the name for that type of podcast? It's like when they did the Hamilton one song every episode.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
They're going to dissect this thing.
The room where it happened.
Is that
Trayvon Freeze?
Right. That's like a whole
thing. I was the first guest on that podcast.
Yeah. it's a lovely podcast. I highly recommend it. Can we jump back to something a minute ago?
Yeah, by all means.
So we were talking about Star Wars and how they did massive reshoots on Solo and Rogue One.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think we all ended up on the same page with Last Jedi. I mean, it is my favorite Star Wars movie at this point. But it's interesting to me that they did massive reshoots on Rogue One, and it turned out really well. Like that, I think that movie works on every it tells a really compelling story at the end. I'm really sad about the way it ends, but it's really the perfect way for that movie to end.
So really, I agree.
And Solo kind of falls a little flat. But they had a similar, like, how do they have a similar, like, how do they do it right with one and swing and miss, right?
I have no idea.
This is the billion-dollar question.
It is a billion-dollar question.
Alchemy of movie making.
On one hand, you have, from what I understand from the interviews with him, Tony Gilroy, one of the producers of Rogue One, was key and instrumental to those reshoots. And he's an amazing writer and actually an amazing director in his own right. Mm-hmm. Michael Clayton's one of my favorite movies of that genre of, I don't even know what you'd call that genre, but it's like the Alan Pakula, 1970s parallax view type films that, good thriller. Yeah. But again, these kind of things, I could only imagine when you fire two people that have already shot most of a movie and you bring in Ron Howard, these are things that nobody outside the studio will ever fully know the actual story on. I just resolved myself to knowing that you were never going to know. Obviously, they were trying to make a great movie that stuck, and something didn't quite gel.
So on a completely different note, did you read the thing yesterday about Last Crusade?
Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
About the screenplay?
No.
So that movie had rewrites. Gary Whitta, friend of the site, yeah, and Rogue One screenwriter, posted about it yesterday. I'll dig out the link and send it to you, so you can put it in the show notes, and you should absolutely read it, because it goes through and it compares the original draft that somebody found, unearthed recently,
right,
to the shooting script, to what was actually shot. And it goes through and explains the beats in a really interesting way, and the way they like the way that movie escalates over time. So the threat is constantly ramping up versus, like, originally, for example, in the original script that was written by the credited screenwriter, who I can't remember who it is off the top of my head. When Indy goes to his dad's house, he finds his housekeeper dead in the house, which immediately sets a tone that this is a life or death peril versus, hey, my dad's missing. Right. He's gone off on a walkabout. There's the Brotherhood of the Cruciform Sword was originally a minion of the Sultan who's working with the Nazis. So he's just a garden variety bad guy, Nazi stooge, versus a person who has been working with a group for thousands of years
to protect the
secret. And it's like these tiny, tiny, tiny little changes that made that movie a phenomenally, but like, I can't imagine what the movie would have been like as the way the script was originally described.
Fascinating. That kind of unpacking. There's a really great documentary, it was a long form article about the making. And we talked about this on the podcast, the making of The Thing.
Yeah.
How having two or three months between the interior photography and the exterior up in Alaska, Carpenter basically edited the whole film, saw ways in which he could make it more efficient, changed the shooting script radically because they'd shot almost exactly this script. And then because of these efficiencies, there's one character that dies and it's never explained, or it's never actually clear who kills them, but it doesn't matter because you're not paying attention
to that. Who cares?
That
person didn't matter.
That's awesome.
I mean, we saw a glimpse of it when we went to the Stanley Kubrick exhibit, and you saw the Spartacus script and all his handwritten notes and all those things. And we would love kind of like a script editor's commentary would be great.
And I mean, with Kubrick, I've come to the mythos is that Kubrick was like, every frame was drawn carefully and he shot exactly. I don't think that's the case at all.
I don't think anything
after
be
looking
like that
at
the
exhibit. The
Yeah,
I think that Kubrick shot as much as he possibly could so that when he got into the edit room, the film that came out of the edit bay could be what it wanted to be, that he had all the coverage necessary to let the thing unfold in and of itself. And that's a wonderful way to work, but it's very different than the mythos of the hyper precision.
Right. Yeah. And it just happens that because he has a great eye, every shot that he shot was probably fantastic.
Right.
And that's why the cream of the crop is that good.
Well, and it's also possible that his process changed from the time he made Spartacus to the time he made Eyes Wide Shut, because that was, 35, 40 years.
By all means. Yeah.
Before we continue this week, I want to let you know that Still Entitled is also made possible with support from TripleByte. Because applying to programming jobs sucks. You have to put the right keywords in your resume. You spend hours and hours on phone screens and take-home projects. And that's assuming the company even responds to your application. Well, if you're a software engineer, TripleByte can help. They work with over 400 top tech companies, from big names like Dropbox and Adobe to exciting startups. You do one brief online interview with them, and if you do well, you get to go straight to final interviews with the companies on their platform. It's like the common app for software engineers. TripleByte does not look at your resume or where you went to school. All they care about is if you can code, because that's what really matters. Not a sheet of paper. It's about your personal experience and about your abilities. Apply now at triplebyte.com/untitled. That's TripleByte, B-Y-T-E, byte as in 8 bits. And as a special offer for listeners of the show, if you take a job through TripleByte, they'll offer you a $1,000 signing bonus. Now back to the conversation.
There's no way to get from Eyes Wide Shut. I do want to hear about your time at FanFusion in Phoenix.
Phoenix FanFusion was fantastic.
Your first time.
At Phoenix FanFusion was fantastic. A little alliteration.
Ooh, yeah, I know.
And you did an incognito, real incognito this time. Tell us about your walk through
the convention. Well, I didn't tell people I was hitting the floor. I brought a costume. I brought a costume that I had not worn in public before. Well, actually, I tell a lie. I wore this costume actually in order to go see Endgame with Kishore.
Oh, nice.
And hold on just a second. I'm looking. Sorry. Yeah. My costume was a Captain America Civil War suit built by Robert Fitch and Kevin Gossett.
Okay.
And they specifically used the same techniques to build this suit that the original movie suit was, which is it's all sewn out of four-way stretch dance fabric, Lycra.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But the patterning on it is a screen printed pattern to make it look like it's ballistic nylon.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
That's the trick to get the actors comfortable wearing these suits all day.
Well, it turns out what a huge expense on a Marvel film, Deborah Nadelman Landis told me this, a huge expense in the Marvel universe is getting the actors out of their costumes so they can eat.
Oh, wow.
And getting them back in.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, you could lose a couple of hours of production time with that. And so they started making cap suits more wearable. And apparently, by Winter Soldier and Civil War, he's like, oh, this is super comfortable. I can wear this all day long. I don't need to take it off.
So you had the helmet.
I had the helmet.
You were walking around.
I put it on. I did not shave my mustache.
Okay.
Or I did not shave my beard. So I'm walking around.
Your take on Cap. Yep.
What's that?
Your take on Cap.
It's my take on Cap.
Old Cap. Old man Cap.
Well, I didn't think of it. That comes later.
Middle-aged Cap, Norm.
Oh, I'm happy to be old Cap. So I'm walking. I'm coming down the escalator into the main vendor floor,
mm-hmm.
and I'm one third of the way down the escalator when the guy behind me goes, "Hey, Adam." I got found about half a dozen more times.
You need to build some bad costumes. Well, that's the only way out of this problem.
I think you're plausibly right. It was a fun costume to wear. It's a very easy costume to wear. It's super comfortable. It feels really good. I have a pair of big foam boobs inside to actually fill it out, and I'm going to have to add biceps. I noticed in the mirror I look a little.
So you like your Thor muscle suits too much?
Oh, yeah, way too much. Yeah, okay. No, I need this muscle by muscle I need to put into this thing.
How was the convention? The floor.
Convention is great. The convention floor felt really big.
Was this at the Phoenix Convention Center, the big one downtown?
Not sure.
Okay.
I think so. I'm sorry. I get to these places and I'm in and out of my hotel room and mostly it's like a whirlwind. The people were great. The people that we dealt with there was great. I got to spend a bunch of time in the green room. I did not approach Jeff Goldblum.
What?
He's too important to me.
Is this the one? He's the one you can't talk to.
Well,
you talked to Harrison Ford.
Harrison Ford came over and talked to me.
Okay, that's different.
Paul Rubens was there.
What?
This lovely, sweet, sweet little girl, maybe 5 years old, started saying something about atoms, and her dad said, "Well, here's an atom." And she started telling me facts about atoms.
That's amazing.
That were amazing. Like, she was super, super on her physics.
That's right.
At five, just fully explaining to me how atoms work. And then she says, and they're responsible for electricity. And I said, well, actually, a part of them is responsible for electricity. And she was like, what? And I was like, well, there's components of an atom, a neutron, proton, and electron. And electrons make electricity. And she was like, I got to tell you something. And then she like downloaded some more information. It was, it turned out to be Summer Glau's daughter, I believe.
Oh, that's awesome.
Just adorable and very sweet.
That's very good.
That's really cool.
It was a very fun green room. Very lovely. Nichelle Nichols was there. I also didn't approach her. Again, in the green room is...
It's a private time.
It is. And then I went out and I took pictures with 750 people in a five-hour marathon that I have not done such a thing before.
Wow.
I have to tell you, the next day I was sore across my whole body just from the kind of all that energy. It was really... it was fabulous. The fans were great. The costumes, phenomenal.
Oh, I saw someone as a rocket, like a Saturn V or like a...
Yeah, no, she was a Falcon Heavy.
Oh, Falcon Heavy, that's
right.
What it was.
This
that's
girl awesome. Wearing a backpack that was a giant, like 9.5 foot tall
booster,
Falcon Heavy.
That's amazing.
Wearing a SpaceX spacesuit.
Oh, that's great.
Phenomenal. There was a Hell Girl. There was a Hellboy. This young woman came up in the, what is the Star Wars dancing character with the two?
Oh, like the Twi'lek dancing
I think so.
Girl?
This
yeah.
woman came up lady. Dressed as that and said that actually she got into cosplay because of watching stuff on Tested and now
That's
she was
amazing.
A featured cosplay speaker at the Fan Fusion.
That's rad.
The fan love was real and abiding and really made me glow. It was delightful.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, there's also some good cosplay at Maker Faire, and they're trying to bring more of the cosplay as a track there.
This is the second year they've done it, right?
Yeah, yeah. They brought in a bunch of cosplayers, Egg Sisters, Jackie Craft. And did we all judge cosplay contests and prop building contests and some really great stuff. And the guy who won like the best prop made the exoskeleton from Elysium.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Was that an RPF build? Is that the guy who's been
doing it on the
RPF?
Yeah. And it's one of those things that, like, I don't know anyone who likes the film Elysium.
I like the way it looked.
But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you like the film. The props, you can still love making the costume and props from it because you can still appreciate all of that design.
Indeed.
And costuming.
So we didn't talk about the end. Like, speaking of props and costuming, like, the end. Sorry to add money to my meter. We had to talk. We haven't talked about the end of Game of Thrones here, I don't think, yet. Right?
And that's a television show, yes?
I believe so, yes. It's on the Home Box Office Network. But, I mean, there was a lot of kerfuffle about the end of the show, but we had the opportunity a couple of times to see the props and costumes and
in person, and they have them in AT&T stores around the country.
Oh, really?
Still,
really?
It's all HBO is owned by AT&T now.
It was amazing. Like the work that the people that worked on that show did was the most amazing I've ever seen in terms of props and costumes.
Really?
Like, those things were built. Those dresses and the armor and all that stuff was built to withstand a level of inspection that would never happen on TV.
So awesome.
So I know you don't watch the show, Adam.
Yeah.
But
I will.
It doesn't even.
You're probably fine.
You don't need to. But the thing I'll send you links to is after every episode this past season, because every episode this last season was like an hour and a half, basically a movie that they made for like $15 million each episode. And, they do a behind the scenes piece. They had a team on set to film like the making of, and the best stuff is always with the prop makers and the set designers. And they talk about very openly about the kind of problem solving, the unique problem solving they have to do for these giant battle scenes. Like, for example, how do you get giant stacks of zombie carcasses to lay around a castle? Do you have the prop team make 1,000 bodies? No. That's super expensive, super heavy. And they came up with a way to basically vacuum form, basically make a
vacuum form corpse mound?
Corpse mound that they could dress that would be light enough that then they can stack in place and then put a few extras on top of those.
Crazy.
Stuff like that. That's the best part, I think, of the season of Game of Thrones.
I never watched the show really, but I look at the costumes. And you know that even a dress that like somebody wears for a half a scene and is on screen for 3 minutes has the most amazing embroidery and beadwork that you've ever seen on a piece of costume work. Anyway, sorry, okay. I completely non-sequitured there.
No, that's all right.
It's an episode of non-sequiturs. I will give one final recommendation for the movie Booksmart.
Yep. Yes. Olivia Wilde's directorial debut.
Ooh, am I correct? It's out in theaters. It's a wide release. And it might be in theaters for just a couple more weeks because it didn't do so well for the holiday break, so highly recommended.
I'm so glad to hear that. The trailer, I loved the trailer. Those two actresses seemed amazing. And what I've been hearing is it's like a super raunchy comedy that's not...
So
that threads this interesting needle of being both really funny and really true and raunchy and really sweet all at the same time.
And that's all true. And I think the easy pitch was this is super bad, but two girls.
Right.
Right. And it's even easier.
But
pitch
I've heard
one
that
of those
a little
two
more
girls
complex than that. Am
is
I right?
Way more complex. Yeah. And one of the leads is Jonah Hill's sister even. So like it's very easy to make that comparison as a way to get people in the theaters. I think it's a much better movie than Superbad. Superbad's, I think, has some great, heartfelt moments. Yeah. But this movie, and I can't relate to the kids in this, right? These are 18-year-olds in high school, and they're two girls. Like, I don't know what it is that makes it true, but it just felt true.
That's awesome. Olivia Wilde's been tweeting about it and saying, get out there if you want more. Look, if there are good movies, it's important that we go see them in the theater to support them, because this...
That's how you get more good movies. If you want less TV and more movies, go see movies.
I read this wonderful defense of Jupiter Ascending that was like, hey, it may be really problematic, but bless the Wachowskis for going out way over their skis to try out stuff like this that's original and different.
Agreed. More Speed Racer, too.
Yeah.
I mean, please, more Speed Racer. For the love of God.
Or they're going to bring back The Matrix.
Well, this has gone all over the place.
Yeah. Non-sequitur.
That's what happens
show,
when we don't podcast for a while.
It's true.
Yeah, we got to get it all out.
You are going to be gone this weekend. You're going to be in New York.
I am.
So BookCon, I believe.
It's BookCon. It's an In-N-Out, something like 36 hours.
What's your food strategy? Well, I guess you'll tell us that. You won't want to spoil it because,
I have no idea.
Okay.
I don't know.
I haven't considered.
I always make sure I have one Sabrett's hot dog at least.
Okay.
Because the New York Sabrett's hot dog is the shizzle.
So this time of year, you could get the ice cream from the trucks on the side of the road, too.
I never do that.
Really?
Yeah.
No, that's always
it's just the hot dog.
Okay.
So the book tour is still going strong. I think there's still a couple more dates, even in the Bay Area.
Yeah, I'm heading to Palo Alto tomorrow. The questions from the audiences on this book tour have been amazing. I got to have a lovely some drinks with author who just signed a book deal, Lauren Hoff, who's the writer of that wonderful long-form piece in HuffPo over Christmas about being a cable guy in the D.C. area for 10 years, having installed cable in Dick Cheney's house.
Wow.
Oh, it's... We should put this link in the show notes. Because
you give Dick Cheney the, hey, I can hook you up with HBO for free deal. You just stab him a few times.
I also got to hang out with a couple of other Austinites. Although Evan Narcisse reached out to me and he was like, hey, I just walked past you taking a bunch of photos with fans at the Alamo Draft House. And I had been trying to remember who I had met last year, who I knew lived in Austin that I wanted to hang out with.
And it was Evan.
And when he texted me, I was like, damn it, Evan, it's you. I wanted to hang out. And so next time I go to Austin, I'll make sure I reach out.
I finally saw Vice, speaking of Cheney.
Dude.
That's a really good-ass movie.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sam Rockwell's always good, it turns out.
Dude, yeah, he's fabulous.
Okay, sorry.
And on the site, we did publish... One Day Build last week.
Boom!
So please check that out. It is the scratch building and kit bashing of a spaceship using Adam's vacuum former.
There's already someone on Twitter who's done like a high-end CG version of it. Super sweet.
Yeah. And same with, you did a video a week and a half ago about Nilo's art with Brandon from Prop Store. And one of the artists, or one of the pieces that you liked, someone turned that into a model as well.
I saw that and they 3D printed it already.
Yeah. That's you guys out there are amazing. We'll end that.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks for coming by, everybody. See you all next week.
Yeah. We'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening this week. And once again, Still Entitled is made possible this week with support from the Rochester Institute of Technology. Did you know that faculties and students there recently built a robot fish because it could lead to a new wave of prosthetics? And now we're all hooked. At RIT, that creative team of engineers is onto something life-changing. Learn more about that project at rit.edu/untitled. And we'll see you next week.